Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode, a conversation with Dean Susan Fournier, where she answers the question at the heart of the show.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point. The president's former fixer transfixed the nation. Michael Cohen testified that President Trump broke the law while in office with a plot to keep an affair silent. And Cohen sought to define his ex-boss for posterity.
I know what Mr. Trump is. He is a racist. He is a con man. And he is a cheat.
And returning from a high-stakes summit with North Korea's Kim Jong-un, Trump said he was presented with a choice, a bad deal or no deal. He chose the latter.
They were willing to denuke a large portion of the areas that we wanted, but we couldn't give up all of the sanctions for that. So we continue to work and we'll see, but we had to walk away from that particular suggestion. We had to walk away from that.
Join us. What do you make of the Cohen hearings? What do you think the moment represents for the president? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org, on Twitter, Facebook, at On Point Radio. With us from Washington is Kimberly Atkins, senior Washington correspondent for WBUR. Kimberly, I think it is your first time on Point after having joined WBUR. Certainly your first time here at Folkenflik Fridays. Kim, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. Happy to be here.
That's great. Also with us from Washington, I think also our first time, Tiana Lowe, commentary writer for the Washington Examiner. Tiana, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, not quite his first time on the show, On Point news analyst Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, David, Kim, and Tiana.
We're talking about the week's stories. I think we have to go first to what transpired today, this week, rather, at Capitol Hill. Michael Cohen, in testimony on Wednesday, spoke with a House Oversight Committee. He is a guy who's been convicted of lying and said he was there to take the measure of what really happened and to remedy what he had to say. He told the House Oversight Committee that when he previously lied to Congress, he was doing it to protect President Trump, but that he's not lying anymore.
To attack me every single time about taxes, I have no credibility. It's for exactly that reason that I spent the last week searching boxes in order to find the information that I did, so that you don't have to take my word for it. I don't want you to. I want you to look at the documents, and I want you to make your own decision.
Kim Atkins, help walk us through what Michael Cohen said the president did and why it matters.
Yeah, so a few things. I mean, he talked a little bit about the president said that that the president was aware of efforts to coordinate with at least some Russian nationalists. That infamous Trump Tower meeting that involved members of his campaign team and several Russians, that he knew about it beforehand, that he overheard a conversation with Don Jr. and the now president saying that he spoke to overheard a conversation between Donald Trump Jr. and the president that Roger Stone was going to coordinate with WikiLeaks to release emails that were stolen in that DNC hack, and probably and potentially most problematic for the president, Michael Cohen presented checks that Donald Trump wrote to him after he was president that he says were reimbursements for hush money payments to two women from before the campaign. So, of course, that would be conduct that took place after his election while he was in the White House. All of these things are problematic. They are certainly going to have the close attention of both the Southern District of New York, which is investigating campaign finance violations and other things, as well as Robert Mueller and his investigative team, as well as congressional Democrats who sort of were taking a checklist of potential witnesses to call or other documents to seek based on Michael Cohen's testimony. So despite the fact that Cohen himself has lied before Congress before, and of course that creates a credibility problem for him, the fact that he brought several documents to back up a lot of the things that he was saying boosted that credibility and certainly has Democrats interested in what he has to say. In fact, he's going to be back on Capitol Hill next week for another closed-door session.
And indeed was apparently in closed-door sessions after that testimony with folks in the House Intelligence Committee. Tiana Lowe, how credible did he strike you in watching his testimony this week?
On the one hand, Cohen is someone with nothing to lose at this point. Obviously, he's going to prison. He's doing hard time. And he's certainly not trying to curry favor with the president in the hopes of getting a pardon. However, I mean, any future plea deals that can be brokered, I'm sure he's still angling for. So I would say that there was nothing out there that he said that struck me as an outright lie, except for one thing. The most, I think, troublesome political allegation that Cohen made, the idea that Roger Stone told Trump and Cohen before the WikiLeaks email dump that was coming, you know, there's this little nugget buried in there in which Cohen says that Roger Stone alleges that he got off the phone with Julian Assange. Mm-hmm. This is deeply unbelievable. Yes, and this is deeply unbelievable, if only because Assange might be one of the most surveilled men in the Western world. The idea that he could have a phone call without putting dozens of democratic governments on blast is just, I would say, almost impossible. And of course, it's possible that just that would be Stone embellishing and not Cohen lying. Or it could be that Michael Cohen is just a really bad lawyer and a really bad liar. Still, it doesn't necessarily set the stage for criminal collusion. However, if this anecdote is true, this is still deeply immoral and problematic behavior. You know, if Trump knew about this and didn't necessarily report it to the FBI beforehand.
Tiana, I just want to quickly ask a little bit about how this is playing in conservative circles. We have a clip of Tennessee Republican Congressman Mark Green, who it's sort of a representative clip, attacking Michael Cohen's credibility during the testimony.
No one can see this guy as credible. He will say whatever he wants to accomplish his own personal goals. He's a fake witness, and his presence here is a travesty. I hope the American people see through this. I know the people back in Tennessee will.
Like a number of his Republican colleagues, Green asked about future sources of revenue, was very interested in a book deal, which Cohen refused to say he would not pursue after his time in prison. But how is this defense playing in conservative circles, Tiana, particularly given that the Republicans themselves didn't seem particularly interested in any of the specifics of what Mr. Cohen was alleging?
Well, as my colleague Byron York said, attacking Cohen's credibility at this stage in the game is sort of a double-edged sword, because while Cohen's testimony was bad for Trump politically, he made it pretty clear that there's not any criminal case for collusion based on what he knows personally. So, I mean, it sounds like the Southern District of New York already has the goods on Trump with regards to the Stormy Daniels payment, if that does in fact constitute a campaign finance violation. Sure, Cohen provided evidence, but that's not really the House Oversight Committee's job. The Southern District of New York would already have that handled. So, not that this was in any way a good thing for the president, but it could have gone a lot worse. Cohen could have provided goods on illegal behavior that we didn't know about, specifically with regards to the Russia collusion allegations, but he didn't. You know, I mean, the worst stuff that Cohen said are things that he cannot possibly corroborate, you know, the anecdotes about casual racism, and then even just the idea that he overheard the president and Don Jr. discussing a meeting, having it handled. That could have been referring to anything. So, I mean, obviously, the RNC has not handled this well at all, personally attacking Cohen and celebrating the idea that he's going to prison, which is, you know, a little politically rough, I would say. But really, the outrage over Cohen is not strategically necessarily terribly wise, considering that if you're a Republican interested in seeing Trump be a two-term president, the number one thing you want is for Mueller to not prove a criminal case of Russia collusion. And right now, there still lacks material evidence that we've seen as the public that Trump is in, that Trump is indeed guilty of a crime.
So let me turn now to you, Jack Beatty, and paint what you think is the larger picture. Was this not so bad for the president, or was this the bombshell that a lot of the news coverage suggested?
Well, I turned on Fox last night, and several of the hosts were saying, no bombshell, no collusion. We even heard it from Mr. Cohen. Mr. Trump himself said Cohen was telling the truth about that. That's the one thing. So claims are being made that it was good for the president. We'll have to see. You know, as Churchill said about the Battle of El Alamein, this was not the beginning of the end, but the end of the beginning. And one feels that way about this event. It was 14 months after John Dean's testimony, and I think it was June of 1973, that Richard Nixon left office. Mm-hmm. And watching this, one felt a little of what one felt watching Mr. Dean talk about a cancer on the presidency. What I was struck with most was the Republican response. No defense of Trump's character. No joining with the charges saying that can't be true. Just an effort to discredit the witness, easily done given his record. And there was a kind of raw political fear there of being primaried, of Trump putting someone in the lists against them. All this led to Pete Wehner, who's three-time GOP, been in three Republican administrations, to write that the Republicans are dedicated to annihilating truth to defend Trump. And you could see that in Jim Jordan, the ranking member. He's on record as saying he can't name a single thing that Trump has lied about this, when the Washington Post tally is now 8,700 false or misleading statements.
He seemed to be rolling up his shirt sleeves to take on the witness, but not willing to engage in any of the substance there. It was notable, it seemed to me, that there was no effort at sort of anything across the aisle to except in perhaps one or two brief exceptions to try to drill down on that. We're talking about the week's top stories. We've been starting with I think some reason with the hearings on the Hill a bit earlier this week. We've got calls lighting up the lines here. We'll be taking some of them right away at the top of the next segment. You can join our conversations. What questions do you have about Michael Cohen's testimony and about their implications for President Trump? I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken?, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. These days, it's hard to ignore the debate over the role business should play in society.
There's crescendo around profit, period. Is profit bad? Is capitalism evil? These themes are out there.
Is this criticism of business warranted? And if so, how do we fix it? Stick around until the end of this podcast for a preview of the first episode of the Is Business Broken podcast.
This is On Point. I'm David Folkenflik. We're talking about the week's news. You can join our conversation about Michael Cohen, the president, and his battles with congressional Democrats. What questions do you have? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. My guest today, Kimberly Atkins of WBUR, Tiana Lowe of The Washington Examiner, and On Point's own Jack Beatty. Want to take a couple of calls quickly, see if we can get some feedback on those. Barry, you're calling from Boston, Massachusetts. What struck you about this hearing?
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Two things struck me. Early on, there was a discussion about Cohen's lying before Congress. And then he said that he coordinated that with a couple of the lawyers in the Trump cabinet or whatever, which means he implicated those two lawyers in his lying before Congress. So he dragged two people in. The other thing was late in it, when Ocasio-Cortez spoke, she said, did the president inflate assets to an insurance company? And Cohen said, yes. Well, that's insurance fraud, and I hadn't heard that one brought up before. I've heard the bank fraud and the others, but the insurance fraud has another aspect.
All right. Well, Barry, Thank you, Barry, for that. I'm going to turn to my resident attorney, Kim Atkins. Help me out on this. Was there a claim? I remember mentioning the application to Deutsche Bank by the president. Was there a mention about the insurance? I only watched about 7 hours, but yes. I may have missed it.
Yes, Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez was the, I believe, third to last person to question. But she did come in asking very specific questions about it, including that valuation boosting question where Michael Cohen did say that the president inflated values for insurance purposes, too. These are all things that is going to, like, as I said, both the Oversight Committee and relevant investigators, federal investigators, are going to take a closer look at. One thing that becomes potentially more difficult is bringing those kinds of charges against the sitting president may be very difficult to do. Something like that has not been done. And depending on if he's reelected, I don't know what the statute of limitations for those types of things would be if they've already run. But those are definitely things that I think investigators are going to look at. And as for the other part, yes, Michael Cohen said that the statements, the false statements, which he gave to Congress before, include a statement that he made that was reviewed and edited by President Trump's personal attorneys. And during his testimony, he said those attorneys were Jay Sekulow and Abby Lowell. If I'm sure that both of them will be called to testify now before that committee to find out, among other things, if they suborned perjury in doing that. It depends on what editing means and what they did or did not insert and what can be proven. But it is a troubling accusation.
Wow. Let's take a call now from St. Cloud, Minnesota. Brian, go ahead. What's on your mind?
Yeah, hey, how you doing? Thank you for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to know, I'm a Republican, and I'm trying to understand, how is it that the GOP are figuring that Mr. Trump has not done anything wrong as far as inflating his numbers for a bank loan and for insurance? Those are fraud. Those are federal crimes there alone. And then the emollient clause. So I'm trying to understand, your Cohen has been with him 10 plus years, and yes, he has already pleaded guilty, but yet that's how the mafia worked. That's how they got the mafia. They didn't get someone from the outside. They got someone from the inside. So I'm just truly, really, really, truly trying to understand this as we go through this process.
Terrific. Right. Well, let's see. Let's see if we can shed some light for you on that, Brian. I actually really appreciate that question. Tiana, you know, the Washington Examiner certainly swims in conservative circles, has its finger on the pulse. Answer Brian's question on that.
I think the problem with, you know, the obvious illegal or illegality of Trump's actions or immorality of his actions, depending on how much evidence there is, the difficulty with Trump specifically is that he already was such a known entity in 2015, not for just being a businessman, but for being a celebrity. You know, this is someone whose sex life was on the cover of the New York Post. He was famous for firing people. He was famous for being rude. People knew that he would, swindle basically people out of deals. So the difficulty is now, like, he was elected, and I think that the stakes were set so high after his election in terms of what would be unearthed about illegality. You know, I mean, we were talking about in January of 2017, direct communications or possible direct communications between Trump and Putin, you know, that they had this extraordinary plan to rig the election. So now when we're talking about lesser crimes that are still bad for anyone to commit, but much less the leader of the free world, I think that it's sort of I think especially on the right, there's a total like desensitization to Trump's behavior in particular. And is this good for the country? No. But I do think that's why the media needs to be careful in terms of how salient their outrage is over various things. You know, obviously committing a literal crime, that's a much bigger deal than, you know, the day-to-day lies that we've become so accustomed to. And it's unfortunate that's the way it is, but it really is about how much we've desensitized the public to outrage.
Chuck Beadie, I want you to listen to the president's own words. During a press conference yesterday in Vietnam, Trump described Michael Cohen's hearing as a fake hearing. But he said that Cohen told the truth about one thing. That is what Trump said was the most important question up for consideration.
He lied a lot, but it was very interesting because He didn't lie about one thing. He said no collusion with the Russian hoax. And I said, I wonder why he didn't just lie about that, too, like he did about everything else. I mean, he lied about so many different things. And I was actually impressed that he didn't say, well, I think there was collusion for this reason or that. He didn't say that. He said no collusion. And I was a little impressed by that, frankly.
You know, as Tian and others have pointed out, there was, you know, he stopped short of saying he had any evidence of any collusion, Jack. And at the same time, I wonder what the takeaway is for you in terms of not, hey, is Trump operate in a less than admirable way, but hey, there's a real problem politically, legally, constitutionally in the way that Trump operates that we gleaned from this hearing as opposed to that we might have carried in our head prior to this week.
I think it confirmed our sense of the problems that are out there for the president, that let's put it this way. He's morally oblique, insensitive. He's not alive to the to his own misconduct. He's not a man of given to reflection about it. And he will consistently lie about things to get out of trouble. But on the Russia matter, no, I think that Tucker Carlson last night, he basically was crowing, as I said earlier, saying, hey, there it is. There's somebody who's known him for 10 years, who's close to Trump as anyone. He says, I've seen no evidence of collusion. Although, as Kim says, there is that report about the conversation with the Sun about the meeting in Trump Tower. There is phone call from Roger Stone. So that Tucker just pushed out of the way. But my point is, I think there is something here that Republicans and conservatives are grabbing onto, just as the president did, and saying, whew, no collusion.
You know, it reminds me of President Trump's rationale for his earlier false claim when he denied that he had anything to do with Don Jr.'s statements about the meeting with Russians in the summer of 2016 at Trump Tower. Trump's line about why he had falsely denied it to reporters was, quote, that's not a statement to a high tribunal of judges. That's a statement to the phony New York Times. In closing this little element of what we've been talking about, I do want to leave us with a warning sound of Michael Cohen, very dire and apocalyptic, may or may not be borne out by the facts. But Michael Cohen said that his loyalty to Trump had cost him everything, his family's happiness, friendships, livelihood, and freedom. But then he said there was a greater reason for him to testify.
I will not sit back, say nothing, and allow him to do the same to the country. Indeed, given my experience working for Mr. Trump, I fear that if he loses the election in 2020, that there will never be a peaceful transition of power. And this is why I agreed to appear before you today.
Sounding a serious note of warning there, Michael Cohen, earlier this week in front of the House Oversight Committee. Thousands of miles away, a half world away, President Trump was seeking to burnish his legacy, strike a grand deal, achieve something, and perhaps in the process distract attention from what was happening here at home. We're talking, of course, about his talks with North Korea and particularly his leader-to-leader talks with Kim Jong-un. Jack Beatty, I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this. The president, as we heard earlier, said that there was no deal to strike, that there were too much desired in concessions, and the president walked away. What do you make of this presidential-level summitry, and what do you make of the implications of his desire to engage the North Korean authoritarian ruler Kim on in this way?
Well, you know, as one expert said, he did avoid a catastrophic success, which would have been some preemptive concession that would have made John Bolton's head spin. Instead, that he walked away, and I think he deserves a measure of credit for that. On the other hand, he walked away because they had not done the preparation in advance, it seems to me, to wire up some kind of deal, that this was a rushed matter, that the North Koreans seemed to calculate that the president's political peril would be at the maximum and that they could, demand the moon and sixpence or an end to sanctions in return for stopping, you know, shutting down their nuclear reactor, their nuclear testing site. So we avoided the catastrophic success. He walked away, but it was a failure nevertheless, given the president's own expectations and given the sort of momentum of what looked like warming relations with North Korea. What will happen next? We don't know. And some people are worried that it might be a return to the harsher tone of earlier days for Mr. Trump.
Jack, briefly, you and I talked a little bit before the show about Otto Warmbier, who had been a prisoner in North Korea. President Trump sort of gave Kim a pass. He said the North Korean dictator was unaware of the harrowing treatment that Warmbier had endured while detained there, the torture and death he suffered in the hands of the North Koreans. And the parents issued a pretty rough statement to NBC News, I guess, among others, saying they must speak out. They said, Kim and his evil regime are responsible for the death of our son, Otto. Kim and his evil regime are responsible for unimaginable cruelty and inhumanity. No excuses or lavish praise can change that. Trump, on the other hand, is trying to strike a deal that, you know, if you denuclearize North Korea, could, you know, create greater prospects for peace. Do you have to dance with a dictator quite like that?
Well, you know, Rick Santorum is among the president's most indefatigable defenders on CNN. He called that moment reprehensible. That seems to me justified. Bill Kristol, also a conservative, called Trump the last Stalinist apologist. The Stalinist apologists in the West used to, you know, dress up his murders as progress or as, you know, CIA rumors or as, you know, whatever was convenient to the ideological moment. The president just tossed that away. And when you read about what happened to this young man, his parents, as they were going up the stairway to the plane where he was waiting for them, they could hear his howling in pain. When they got there, they found a young man who was deaf, blind, who couldn't sleep, who couldn't speak, and who, and his according to his father, it looked like some of his teeth, his front teeth, had been pulled out with pliers. 6 days later, he died. How can a president of the United States take the word of this murderous thug that he knew nothing about this when a sparrow can't fall from the tree in that country without the dictator knowing?
I want to turn to another national security question. That is what was reported by the New York Times and then quickly matched by the Washington Post. And that is that President Trump, despite his denials and despite the denials of those who received it, President Trump intervened personally to overrule senior administration officials, including the White House chief of staff, then John Kelly, to make sure that his son-in-law and unpaid advisor at the White House, Jared Kushner, had a fairly high level of security clearance. Kim Atkins, what are the implications of that? The president has the authority to give it to whomever he desires. What are the implications of it? Why does that matter?
Yeah, you're right. The president has the right to grant security clearance to whomever he wants, which is why at the time when it was being reported that Jared Kushner was having trouble getting security clearance for his job based on, in part, his financial dealings with foreign entities, reporters asked the president more than once, are you just going to give it to him? And the president kept saying, no, I'm leaving that. I'm letting that go through the normal process. And then subsequently denied having anything to do with that clearance. It catches the president in a lie, which is one problem. And another, it sort of affirms this idea that there is someone within the White House with security clearance who is involved in such delicate things as negotiating in the Middle East for a potential peace deal, certainly having frequent contact with the Crown Prince of Saudi Arabia. And this person could be compromised in some way. This is the reason why security clearance is required for those types of positions. So it represents a potential national security threat at its worst. And it just shows not just the president, but everyone else who talked about this, including Ivanka Trump, who denied in an interview that the president intervened in either hers or her husband's security clearance. It just makes them look untruthful.
It's fascinating. I guess if you look at the Jared Kushner case and the Saudis and the question of business deal there, it does seem to have echoes of his father-in-law and the question of business deals for the Trump organization with Russia. Tiana Lowe, we have a comment from our website. Gregor's listener posts, Trump is desensitizing legal norms, not just in the U.S. His caustic effect is reaching everywhere. It seems as though that in some ways was inspired by the Cohen testimony, but it applies in some ways in terms of norms when extended apparently to Jared Kushner, who he warned against in about 30, 45 seconds we have for the end of this segment. You know, to what extent do you think that's a fair characterization? Is Trump downgrading legal norms, or are people applying different prisms to a different president?
I don't know if Trump is changing our legal standards because, again, I mean, right now the stickiest crime that Trump's facing is with regards to this Stormy Daniels payment, if that is indeed a campaign finance violation. However, it is a degradation of norms. You know, I think that, I mean, Obama lied. Obama entertained the dictatorships of Iran. However, Obama did it with a little bit more decorum, and I think that we're not used to shedding the decorum. And, of course, Trump does it with more frequency.
Well, we'd like you to stick around. You've been hearing from Tiana Lowe, Kimberly Atkins, Jack Beatty. We've been talking about the week in the news. Coming up, the president struggles with congressional Democrats over policy, among other things. I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. We're talking about the week in the news. We're about to talk about some of the president's battles with congressional Democrats over policy as well as over the conduct of his administration. Follow us on Twitter. Find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. And don't forget to sign up for our weekly newsletter. Our guests today are WBUR's senior Washington correspondent Kimberly Atkins, Washington Examiner commentary writer Tiana Lowe, and On Point's news analyst Jack Beatty. I want to turn abroad for a moment to at least mark and note a sort of amazing development. In Israel, the Attorney General announced yesterday that he would be that he intended anyway to indict the country's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on charges of bribery, fraud, and breach of trust. Netanyahu is up for re-election in 6 weeks. The Prime Minister responded defiantly last night in an address to the nation.
I intend to serve you and the country as prime minister for many more years, but it's up to you. It's not up to civil servants. It's not up to the television studios. It's not up to pundits and journalists. It's only up to you.
Nation's chief executive under legal duress, making somewhat familiar sounding claims about the motivations propelling those who are arrayed against him. It's an important issue. Netanyahu, a defining figure for Israel for about a generation on the country's political scene, and a topic we will be returning to here at On Point. I want to turn back to Capitol Hill now because with a new batch of Democrats now in the majority at the House of Representatives and controlling the agenda there, it seems as though there's a lot going on. Kimberly Atkins, tell us a little bit about a couple of the agenda items. I mean, let's start with just the vote on the president's national security declaration on the southern border. Where does that stand?
Yeah, so the House has passed a resolution that would reverse that emergency declaration. That declaration shifts money that has already been delegated by Congress to other things, things like military construction projects and other matters, to be used, would divert that to be used toward construction of the wall. Like I said, it's already passed the House. And in the Senate yesterday, there was a companion measure offered, co-authored by, it's bipartisan, it's co-authored by Maine Senator Susan Collins, who spoke at length about the fact that it wasn't about whether or not someone supports Trump or not, or even supports the wall or not. It's about the separation of powers and that the executive branch cannot usurp the power of Congress to the congressional power of the purse. And you even had another Republican, Lamar Alexander, yesterday on the floor speaking in support of that measure, quoting Justice Antonin Scalia of the U.S. Supreme Court, really a conservative icon, clearly in a message to urge other Republicans to get on board and back this bill so it would pass too. It would need a veto-proof majority of two-thirds of both houses to override the veto that President Trump has already promised. That would mean at least 20 Republican senators, a very large number of Republican House members. It's unclear whether it'll have that support, but it's looking more likely like it's going to pass.
Nancy Pelosi earlier in the week talked about this issue. When the House voted to overturn it, the National Emergency Declaration, Pelosi accused President Trump of making a power grab.
The heart and the soul of the Constitution is a separation of power with co-equal branches of government to be a balance of power. To achieve that purpose, the founders were very visionary. Many beautiful things came followed that, the Bill of Rights and the rest. But what they wanted to do was to be sure that we did not have a monarchy, but we had three distinct branches of government, a check and balance, one to the other.
Tiana Lowe, you know, a lot of self-proclaimed constitutionalists in the House Republican Conference, that is the Republican members of the House of Representatives, as well as in the Senate side, a lot of folks who have objected to when President Obama extended the authority of the executive branch in ways that they thought was not legitimate or justified under the Constitution. Why has this not drawn more Republican support?
Because the House Freedom Caucus is a lie. Seriously,
it's a lie.
Major credit goes out to Representatives Thomas Massey and Justin Amash for constantly being consistent and being principled. The amount of sycophancy, I think, that we're seeing among Republicans refusing to call this what it is, unconstitutional. As it stands right now, what Trump is doing is probably legal because Congress has failed to define what constitutes as a national emergency in the National Emergencies Act that was passed after Watergate. And Congress should be taking that power back, and Republicans should be voting to overturn this emergency declaration. So on a pragmatic level, Trump still has a few billion dollars he can move around here and there, especially within the DHS with regards to drug crimes on the border. You know, and Trump has been wise in now listening to the DHS and supporting the steel slats. People have been mocking it, but let's be realistic. The southern border is a very varied terrain. You don't need 2,000 miles of concrete wall. You need a couple hundred miles of steel slats to solve the very real issue of border security. However, Trump does not get to announce a national emergency when, while the situation is urgent, it is no emergency, just because he doesn't get what he wants. And it's up to Congress to take that power back. Republicans should vote to overturn this, but more importantly, they should be trying to update the National Emergencies Act to clearly define and constrain the power of the president. They have abdicated this responsibility for far too long, and it's time for them to do something permanent. You know, overturning this specific declaration will set good precedent in the future, but what Congress really has to do is rewrite the law as a whole.
So you're saying, constricting the power of the presidency rather than constricting the power of this president.
Exactly. You know, when Harry Reid nuked the filibuster, it obviously went around to it backfired on Democrats wildly. You see, the most successful conservative portion of Trump's agenda right now is his judicial nominees. He's getting them through at breakneck speed, in part because of what Harry Reid gifted Republicans. If Trump doesn't think that this will be used against Republicans in 2020 or in 2024, I have a bridge to sell him. I mean, Democrats are already getting excited to take guns, pass Green New Deals, and they're explicitly saying that they'll use their national emergencies.
It's fascinating. You're also seeing some challenge to the president's position, the White House position, not on authority, but just on legislation. And that Jack Beatty has to do with guns and gun control to the extent of checks on whether or not people should be allowed to buy guns, the expansion of background checks. What was the legislation that the House picked up?
Well, there were two bills, and one, as you say, essentially extends the background check to private firearm sales. This has been a loophole for a long time, and it's a measure favored in some polls by 80-odd% of Republicans even. And the second bill passed yesterday gives the FBI more time to do these background checks on gun purchases. It extends the time from 3 days to 10 and possibly an extension to another 10. This three-day period is called the Charleston loophole after the because that was the there wasn't the FBI didn't have time to complete the background check on the assassin there, the terrorist there, white supremacist terrorist there. Within the 3 days, he bought a gun. He committed the heinous crime. This closes that loophole. And the NRA, after long lucubration, has come up with a defense. And the defense is 3 days. You have to have the shorter period because spouses need to be able to get guns quickly if they're threatened by their husbands. So to defend, vulnerable womanhood, the Republicans are now saying, no, this is taking the guns out of the hands of the of a spouse threatened by a husband. And Debbie Dingell, the Michigan Democrat, gave an impassioned speech in which she said, I had that very situation in my house. My father had a gun and my mother got a gun and the two of them had the standoff and we were in the middle. Insanity.
And she did so in favor of this legislation. Is that right? She made this case
that she's in favor of making
it tougher to get it through private transactions.
Yes. Right.
And interestingly, her late husband, John Dingell, the legendary Michigan Democrat and sort of lion of the House, was a longtime Democratic supporter of the NRA and supporter of what he saw as gun rights. Tiana Lowe, briefly, the NRA has been in the middle of a lot of controversies. It is not it's lost a lot of its financial backing in recent years. It's been caught up in some of the Russia probe and some of the Russia headlines. Does the NRA retain the same stature among Republicans and more generally on the Hill that it once did?
The great myth about the NRA is that it's this nefarious, powerful financial force. The only reason why the NRA has power is because Americans like the Second Amendment. The NRA, it doesn't necessarily do all that much. It's sort of like the same criticisms levied against AIPAC. It's not that AIPAC spends that much money. It's that they have influence because they have ardent supporters. And so I think that the hyper focus on the NRA is, if I were coming from a liberal perspective, misguided. But the difficulty is that the Second Amendment wasn't passed for the pragmatic reason of self-defense. It wasn't passed for the pragmatic reason of hunting. It was passed as a last resort against a government gone rogue or a government gone tyrannical. And I think this is one – guns tend to be one of those things where I think the media tends to deviate far from what the public average is. If you poll people on just gun control, common sense gun control – they'll be overwhelmingly in favor of it. But as questions get more specific, Americans tend to be more and more supportive of gun rights. Things like bump stock bans. Sure, fine, whatever, you can do that, but you can also makeshift a bump stock. Assault rifles. You see people who talk about, well, ban semi-automatic rifles, will ban assault rifles. And they don't even really know what they are. And it's just, again, it's all this misguided energy towards the NRA specifically. If the NRA were abolished tomorrow, something else would arise in its place.
Fair enough. Can I just push back for 30 seconds? As somebody who used to cover Congress, it struck me that the NRA's power was within the ability of the Republican primary season to influence greatly who would be selected or who could get sort of early funding, not necessarily from NRA coffers, but from a network of organizations, like-minded folks. You're saying that basically it was never the case.
No, again, it's not that I think that the NRA lacks any and all influence. It's that I think like the specific organization, it's not that it's this money hub that's extremely powerful. It's that I think that Republicans have a number of litmus tests that, you know, you must pass in order to get through primary seasons. You know, abortion is one of them. Gun rights is another one. And again, I'm just it's more just about the age for all the Maria Butina madness, you know, and her relationship with the NRA. I don't think it's the agency itself that's deeply nefarious or as powerful as liberals sort of like to hypothesize.
Okay. I want to turn to briefly to acknowledge another wrinkle in the House of Representatives' decline to seat Mark Harris, who had been the seemingly victorious Republican candidate in a North Carolina congressional race. He seemed to win by 905 votes. After an examination of that, there was a question of electoral fraud, and he's withdrawn from what will be a rematch this week. A former consultant to him in the 2018 primary faced criminal charges from his activities stemming from 2016 and from the 2018 primary. Now to turn to one last story this hour, political news and history made in Chicago. After an enormous 14-person mayoral election in Chicago, two African-American women came out on top for a runoff. They are Lori Lightfoot and Toni Preckwinkle. They're going to compete in a runoff election on April 2nd. Lightfoot is the first openly gay woman to run for mayor in Chicago, a former federal prosecutor, was the head of Chicago's police board. Preckwinkle is the president of the Cook County Board of Commissioners. Either way, either victor, Chicago will soon have its first black female mayor. Here's Preckwinkle acknowledging that fact to her supporters on Tuesday night after the election.
We may not yet be at the finish line, but we should acknowledge that history is being made.
And now you can hear the voice of her rival, Lori Lightfoot, speaking to supporters after she made the runoff from that pool of 14 candidates.
And it's true that not every day that a little black girl in a low-income family from a segregated steel town makes the runoff to be the next mayor of the third largest city in the country.
Come on now, Kim Atkins, it's a quite a moment from Rahm Emanuel to this. What does it mean for Chicago? What does it mean for politics?
I mean, I think you're seeing on the local level the same thing we've been seeing nationally, which is people making a different decision about who represents them, what it means, and really moving against the establishment. I mean, it seems incomprehensible just a few years ago that someone named Bill Daley would not be elected mayor, who would come in third. And so I think you're seeing that really change in a city like Chicago, which has had a lot of issues with its police department and other matters. I think you're seeing the electorate be responsive to that and look for a new direction in their leadership.
You think about Rahm Emanuel leaving, a hard-driving guy. President Obama once joked about Emanuel, his former chief of staff, that he thought that Rahm Emanuel would be speechless, given that as a young man he had sliced off much of his middle finger. Folks, you've been hearing the wisdom of Kimberly Atkins, senior Washington correspondent for WBUR. Thanks, Kim, for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me.
Tiana Lowe, commentary writer for The Washington Examiner. Thanks for taking the time with us today.
And thank you for having me.
And, of course, On Point's own news analyst, Jack Beatty. Have a great weekend, Jack.
Thank you, David.
You can continue the conversation, get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org, and you can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. On Point is produced by Anna Bauman, Justine Daum, Brian Hardzinski, Eileen Amata, Stefano Katsonis, Allison Poli, Tanya Raleigh, James Ross, Alex Schroeder, and Adam Waller, with help from Matt Hoisch, Asil Kibbe, and Alex Pena. Our executive producer, Karen Schiffman. Me, I'm David Folkenflik, and this is On Point.
Thank you. Support for this podcast comes from Is Business Broken, a podcast from Questrom School of Business. Listen on for a preview of one of the episodes featuring Susan Fournier, Alan Questrom Professor, and Dean.
So let's start this conversation with the title of the show, Is Business Broken? It's a provocative title and a question. Where did this come from? Why that question now?
We're in a big cultural moment where capitalism, business, market systems are really being scrutinized and debated, and the role of business with it. So I think the question is just on the table. It's on people's minds. It's in the news media. It's in conversations. I think there are growing voices, loud voices, especially among young people who seem increasingly to believe that business and maybe capitalism with it are harmful and create rather than solve problems for society. And what we do seem to hear are those loud voices, and they are very black and white. There are protagonists and the antagonists and the pros and the cons, and there's really no middle discussion. It's sort of like people for and against, and it's loud.
Right. For and against DEI, for instance, right? A battle at play.
Right.
The way you describe it and the way you describe the polarization, it makes it feel like very much of the digital age, right? It feels very much of today. Some of those arguments have been around, though, right? Is this criticism of business and this question, is business broken, is that a new question?
You are so right. It is not a new question. Schumpeter, he was a professor at Harvard, and he's also maybe one of the most influential political economists of the early 20th century. He called for the death of capitalism, the death of business, 100 years ago.
Okay. Wow.
And when he critiqued way back then, he said the very successes of capitalism would bring about its downfall because it would create values hostile to capitalism, and that this would particularly take hold among intellectuals who were critiquing. So there's a lot of that same kind of dynamic happening today, and that's 100 years old. But yeah, we've seen this kind of cultural fervor playbook many times in the past, often precipitated by big crises.
Find the full episode by searching for Is Business Broken wherever you listen to podcasts, and learn more about the Mehrotra Institute for Business, Markets, and Society at ibms.bu.edu.